morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Arthur Schultz. I represent the appellants who ask that this court reverse the two orders at issue issued by the district court below. First, I would like to point out that the Navy agrees with the appellant's argument that the district court's decision holding that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applied only to policies or practices that were neutral or general application is contrary to the words of the statute.
Can I just have a factual question for you. Help me understand this. Are any of the plaintiffs challenging the current policy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who is that? Is that Mr. Lindsay?
Your Honor, all of them are challenging the current.
Let me ask you a question this way. Did any of the plaintiffs apply for their positions under the new policy?
Your Honor, Chaplain Lindsay applied, but the...
When was the new policy implemented? Do you know exactly?
Your Honor, they said sometime, I believe, in 2001.
And Mr. Lindsay applied...
In 2001, the 2001-2002 time period,
I believe. You think that was under the new policy?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, they admitted that it was.
The Navy admitted that?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Where?
Your Honor, I challenged the... I believe I interviewed the person who was actually on his board, and he talked about the procedure.
The new procedure or the old procedure?
Under the... Your Honor, I don't think it's clear. Your Honor,
I'm asking because if no one applied under the new procedure and was turned down under it, then you don't, there's no challenge to that, to the new procedure.
Your Honor, the system itself has two components which are identical. One is the unilateral and unfettered discretion to set goals or quotas that are unrelated to the Department of Navy's religious free exercise needs. The second part of that...
You've agreed, haven't you, that under the new policy, it's faith neutral, isn't it?
Your Honor, that's what they said.
But you seem to have agreed with that.
In fact, that's your objection, is
that right? Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. We agree. We object to the fact that there are no goals because this is an accommodation, and accommodation must be focused on meeting the specific burden, and that burden is individual free exercise needs.
Now, if no one applied under the new policy, then how can you challenge it?
Because the care board is the integral part of that same policy. That care board uses...
I understand, but if none of your clients have applied, and you say Mr. Lindsay has, I just can't tell from the record whether he has or hasn't. But if he hasn't, then how can you challenge the new policy?
Because it uses the same care board system, Your Honor, which is dominated by denominational representatives.
But under a completely different set of instructions.
Right. Your Honor, there are no instructions.
But your argument, I thought, was that the old system did involve these quotas, the thirds.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's one set of instructions. Now, and that at least may be the case, that all the plaintiffs applied under that system. You have an objection to that system. But I don't see how that continues on in any meaningful sense under the new system.
Your Honor, can I refer you to the extracts of the record which I've provided for you? Tab number 5. And what tab number 5 shows is what happens on the care board. Our expert looked at the care board records and showed that there are favored denominations who sit as care board members. And those care board members influence the results because when you look at who is selected for both a session, which is on 1791, there is a clear relationship between
this
categories.
This aggregates the old and the new, right?
No.
There's no differentiation of years between 1985 and 2005.
Your Honor, I believe these 5 years that he his records actually show the
I'm just looking at what you've presented to us, and it says considered for accession between 1985 and 2005, so it doesn't seem to disaggregate.
Your Honor, on tab 5, paragraph 63, talks about the members, care board memberships for 5 years. I can't say specifically right here what those 5 years represent. I could submit that to the court if it desires. But the point is that there is a relationship between the denomination of the board member and the results, which shows that your chance of being assessed is influenced by the person's religion. And if you look at the next page, paragraph 64, it applies that same kind of analysis to those who are being considered for active duty. You see a direct relationship between the number of times a person is on a board and the results of who was selected.
I want to go back to Judge Tatel's questions. I've read your complaint, and I don't see anything in this complaint that challenges the policy other than what you call the thirds policy. The complaint is about goals and how, you know, how that violates the statute plus the Constitution. Can you show me in your complaint and the counts where it is that the current or the policy that's in effect now is challenged? Because I don't find it.
Your Honor, the new policy that they so-called adopted was not announced, and when the complaint was drafted, the only thing we had to go on was the old quotas, which
That may be, but the complaint deals only with the quotas and only with the goals. It does not deal with the new policy. Although I must say, in paragraph 23 of your complaint, you recognize that the policy that you're complaining about is no longer in effect. So when you said we didn't have anything to go on, paragraph 23, and it says, well, now there's this new policy, but the one under which my clients, these plaintiffs, applied was unconstitutional. Why? Because it set goals, it had quotas, and so on and so forth. So I don't. How can you possibly take that complaint now and turn it? You didn't amend it. I mean, you did amend it, but you didn't amend it for the current policy.
Your Honor, that complaint also challenges the use of denomination as a basis upon which decisions are made for accessions and for career opportunities in the chaplain corps. Tab 5 clearly shows that there is that relationship. And the care board system, and the kind of information that we have here was simply not available at the time when the complaint was filed. The notice, under the notice procedures, we're saying that this system prefers denomination. The care board is the tool by which those quotas were enforced.
You file a complaint against one system, and that system, at the time you file the complaint, is no longer in effect, as your complaint recognizes.
Your Honor, that's true if you want to say this system is separate. The system is the ability to set goals and quotas and the care boards. I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
In the district court, you, in your motion for summary judgment in the district court, you say that defendants have abandoned any specific faith goals.
Your Honor, I have no evidence that they have not, but they have not abandoned the authority to reset those goals at a later date.
Oh, so now you're arguing that they might reinstitute the thirds policy. That's your point.
They may institute.
So now you're responding to the government's argument that your challenge to the old policy is moot. Is that your point?
No, Your Honor.
No.
I'm saying.
What? I don't understand that.
Your Honor, the system that we challenge allows the government to set goals based on any criteria at all.
But under the new policy, everybody agrees that it's faith neutral. Correct?
As a policy.
As a policy, yes, Your Honor.
So is your point that they have the authority to change that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's why I ask. That, then, is your response to the government's argument that your challenge to the pre-01 policy is moot, right?
Your Honor, we challenge the authority and that allows them to set
challenge
goals.
Unused authority. If the policy is faith neutral, you're right. They probably do have the authority to reinstitute the old policy, but they haven't.
Your Honor,
they haven't alleged anywhere in your complaint that they will.
Yes, Your Honor, in the reply to their opposition to the summary judgment, we said that they have not abandoned their authority and that they may reinstitute it at a later time.
Those are two different questions. I see your point that they haven't abandoned their authority, but where is the allegation in your complaint or anywhere else that they may reinstitute it in the future?
Your Honor, I believe that's in the joint appendix, and that's it talks this session the way we address specifically the fact that they had we said that they were free to reinstitute it.
I don't see how free to reinstitute gets you anywhere.
Right. Your Honor,
suppose they'd been behaving perfectly from 1791 to the present. They would have the authority. That might be a violation of the Constitution, but they would have the authority to change the system and introduce something that you found illegal. They would still have the authority. Their possession of the authority can't possibly be enough.
Your Honor, it's a case called Alaskan Airlines versus United States, in which the government made the same argument. They cited an airline for violations, and then they said, oh, we're going to withdraw the necessary or the attempt to fine them. The court said, well, you still have the authority to do that at any time.
Well, this sounds like a mootness point, not a substantive challenge to the retention of the authority.
Your Honor, mootness requires the defendants to show that there is no possibility that this system will be reinstituted.
They say you've not even alleged that it will be.
Of course they would not allege that it has. Any of those cases in which the courts found that the defendants have not met that, the defendants never say they will do it.
You didn't hear my question.
I'm sorry.
The government's response is you've never alleged that they're going to reinstitute it. So they have no need to respond. They say there's no allegation here that the government will reinstitute the old policy. So there's nothing to respond to. And they say your clients are free to apply under the new policy, right?
Your Honor, the burden is on the defendants to show that they will not do this. And what we're trying to say is that under the accommodation requirements set out by Amos, they must show a rational relationship between the practice that they've chosen to accommodate and the means they've shown. If you don't have any means, if you can't show that you're addressing specific faith group needs, how is it that you can meet that test? Now, let me give you an example.
By the way, that's not an Establishment Clause argument, is it?
Amos was an Establishment Clause?
Yeah, but that sounds like a free exercise argument to me.
Your Honor, Amos was an Establishment Clause?
You just described it. Isn't your point that the current program doesn't respond to the free exercise needs of members of the Navy, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't that a free exercise argument subject to Goldman and the deferential standard of Goldman?
Because, Your Honor, the system shows that the Navy has set up preferences. And the Care Board itself, it puts religion on the board. It delegates civic authority, unfettered civic authority, with no guarantees that authority...
Under your proposed alternative, it would be even more so, wouldn't it? You want the CARE Board to actually take faith into account.
No, Your Honor.
You don't?
We want the CARE Board decisions to be made by line officers, or at least have some means by accountability with objective standards.
But don't you want them to give to take faith into account to make sure that there are enough?
I thought that was your whole argument, Your Honor.
Your argument is they're not hiring enough non-liturgical Protestant.
Your Honor, there are two steps. One is that the government must set goals to meet the needs that it has yet to identify. And let me show you an example of that. They, on page 6 of their opposition, they talk about how they need 10 Muslim chaplains to meet the worldwide requirements. They only have 7. How do you know that they're 10? How do you know that they can't get by with 6, or they're going to need 12? And so what we are saying is that they must...
I thought that the current system simply took the people they regarded as qualified without regard to denomination at all.
Yes, but Your Honor...
And that you objected precisely to that.
Yes, Your Honor, because it does not lift the identified burden of free exercise. And number 7 here is the declaration by Captain Poe, who describes the charismatic Pentecostal communities in Naples and Rota, Spain. He also describes the evangelical communities in Rota, Spain, who were left without chaplains, even though he went and said, look, these are communities. The Navy does not identify these needs.
But you see, that's why this turns on the standard of review, because if it's a free exercise case and we're using the Goldman standard, then the Navy's chaplain program responds to the needs of service members. It doesn't have to respond precisely to everyone.
Your Honor, otherwise, if it doesn't respond to specific needs, then it's the federal clergy jobs program.
That doesn't follow. That's just a logical leap that is impermissible.
Well, Your Honor.
That is to say that there are other factors, and I wanted to ask you specifically, it is your contention that in assignment of chaplains, the Navy must match at each location the precise numbers of each denomination?
Your Honor, we never argue that.
You don't argue that. Well, if you don't argue that, then I'm not sure what the point would be of your anterior step of requiring that the denominations of the chaplains match on an exactly proportional basis the denominations of the Navy personnel.
Your Honor, we never argue that there has to be an exact match. Our argument is that the denominational requirements must be based on the identified needs in an operational context. The Navy makes that same argument on page 6. They say we need 10 Muslims because of the worldwide requirements, and we agree with that.
But you,
we're going to need more Jews.
But you responded to our questions by focusing on Naples, right? A specific place with specific members of the service with specific religious needs.
Yes, Your Honor. A community that's been there since 1990, by the way. Uh-huh. What Chaplain Poe says is that when you look at Navy chaplains, you find the people who populate those chaplains tend to be evangelical or charismatic, and yet the Navy has no means to assure that those needs are met. Now, if the purpose is to remove the burden caused by the Navy's operational requirements, there must be a relationship between hiring chaplains and then meeting that need. A Catholic is not going to satisfy the needs of a Baptist community.
But it ends up being your position, if I get it, that in order to make any kind of chaplaincy program satisfy the Establishment Clause, there must be precise correlation between needs and chaplains' denominations, and that must be manifested on the ground in particular assignments.
And no, Your Honor. Well,
otherwise it seems to fall apart.
Your Honor, in our argument there, we say that you can approach this from an opportunity to have a chaplain of your faith. If you match needs with denominations, then the probability of every sailor, soldier, or Marine finding a chaplain of his faith is about, should be about the same. There is, we do not require strict proportionality at every place. That's just, it's just not workable. And it's just like...
So you recognize that with respect to assignment, there are pragmatic judgments that have to be made. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And wouldn't that also apply on the question of the original accession?
Your Honor, if you
What I'm questioning is your notion that strict scrutiny must apply to the Navy's decisions with respect to denomination as a requirement of not having the chaplain program turn out to be a violation of the Establishment Clause.
Your Honor, in Katkov versus Marsh, which examined the challenge to the Army Chaplain Corps, the first thing it said was that the Army respects the Establishment Clause command of neutrality. It then looked at the Army's way they allocated their chaplain allocations. It used a denominational basis. And that system was used by the Navy prior to the FOS policy, which you'll find at tab, I believe it's tab 4, where they establish arbitrary goals for which there is no support. Now, why? It has the means to identify these opportunities. If it doesn't, and it refuses to do that, then that's active indifference. That's refusing to acknowledge that there is a burden. That makes the government hostile. And that goes back into the argument that the Katkoff said, is if you move a soldier or sailor to a place where he cannot obtain his denominational, he cannot satisfy his exercise needs, that's hostility. The neutrality comes in by saying, we recognize that there is a need, that there is a burden, and we then move to meet that need. You can't meet that need if you don't know what they are. And for the 20 years up until the...
You're way over.
I just have
yes, Your Honor.
I just have one question. I just want to be sure that we're understanding your argument on mootness. Could you just say to us very clearly, what's your best argument for why the challenge to the third's policy is not moot?
Because the care board system is the common element. It puts denomination in the decision process.
Okay. All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Louis Yellen from the Department of Justice. With me at council table are Catherine Hancock, also from the Department of Justice, and Catherine Pasita from the Navy JAG Corps. As the Court has recognized, there are two different policies that are being challenged in this litigation.
Well, that's a question.
Well, that are being challenged in this appeal, in any event, Your Honor.
So would you know the answer to whether or not Mr. Lindsay applied under the new or the old policy?
Our understanding is that he applied under the old policy. The new policy came into effect in October 2000. Just a record site for Your Honors, JA 1195.
October 2000, but didn't
he
say he applied?
In 2000. There's no specified date.
He says he applied in December 2000 and March 01.
Your Honor, I'm not...
That's what he alleges. Say the new policy came into effect?
October 2000.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. 1195
okay, so then
of the Joint
according
Appendix.
According to his allegation, he must have applied under the new policy.
Your Honor, let me just be clear. There was a fourth plaintiff who's no longer in this case, and I just want to make sure that Your Honor is referring to one of the three plaintiffs who is in the case. Plaintiff Myers, who was no longer in this case, did apply under
my
the new
notes
policy.
Here refer to Joint Appendix 283.
JA 283.
Is that not Lindsay we're talking about there?
I'm looking it up right now, Your Honor. Your Honor, JA-283 does refer to a deposition of James Lindsay.
Yeah.
The testimony was that he was rejected in December 2000, and his reconsideration was rejected in March 2001.
Right, wouldn't that have been under the, since the new policy was in effect then? And he also alleges that he was told that if he baptized babies, he would have had a better chance.
He does allege that. He alleges he was told that by a recruiter.
Right, but this is a motion to dismiss at this point.
No, Your Honor, this was summary judgment.
I'm talking about the RFRA claim.
Yes, the RFRA claim was, I'm sorry, the RFRA claim was motion, sorry, was motion to dismiss. That's right, Your Honor.
So that's enough for a motion to dismiss right there, isn't it?
I think it's not, Your Honor.
Why?
Because to state a RFRA claim, you have to allege a substantial burden. In the same deposition, or it's not a deposition, it's the same evidence in which he claims that he was told that if he baptized babies.
A burden to be.
Well, let me, if I may, Your Honor, Lindsay himself said, and I'm quoting, and this is from Joint Appendix 294, and this is in the exchange with the recruiter to which you're referring, Your Honor, and now I'm quoting from Lindsay, quote, I consider myself having had participated in liturgical and non-liturgical. I've done liturgical things, so I have no problem being a liturgical if this small denomination will accept me, close quote. To establish a colorable claim under RFRA, a plaintiff has to at least allege a substantial burden on his religious practice or belief. If Plaintiff Lindsay indicates that he has no problem, his words, being a liturgical, he cannot possibly maintain that a recruiter advising him that the recruiter believed that the reason he was not acceded was because he was a non-liturgical is a substantial burden on his belief. So even under motion to dismiss standards, that is insufficient for a RFRA claim, Your Honor. And again, that's at Joint Appendix 294. So there are two policies, at least in this appeal, the current policy that's been in effect since October 2000 and the prior policy. As the court has alluded to, there appear to be justiciability problems.
Do we know that what the reason for Lindsay's rejection was?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the rejections are publicly stated. The recruiter in that exchange to which I was referring and from which I quoted was speculating about the recruiter's own beliefs about what the reasons may have been. There is no explicit record that I'm aware of as to the specific reasons.
If in fact that was the reason, it would be in violation of the new policy.
Yes, it would be, Your Honor. If it were under the, if the allegation is correct that he was reviewed in 2000 or 2001, and if the new policy did not make
any distinction
among faith groups, and if he was rejected because he was a member of a particular faith group.
That would not give him a right to claim that the new policy was unconstitutional. It would give him a right, if anything, simply to say that the Navy board violated their own policy.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Give rise to a constitutional issue.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
But why doesn't it give rise to a RFRA issue?
Well, again, it doesn't give rise to a RFRA issue, Your Honor, because to state a RFRA claim, you have to show a substantial burden. Lindsay himself indicated that it was not a even assuming the allegation.
I understand your point. Okay.
So for the pre-2001 accession policy, which is being challenged, there is a major problem with justiciability since the policy was not in effect at the time the suit was brought. We put it in our brief. We made our argument in terms of mootness as we were preparing the case and as the court, I think, suggested perhaps in its.
You said the new policy was not in effect at the time the suit was brought?
No, it was in effect. The new policy was in effect. The old policy was not in effect. As I said, our brief argues the justiciability issue in terms of mootness. It may, because the new policy was in effect at the time the suit was brought, it may be that this is more properly thought of as standing. Because to get an injunction and declaratory relief, the plaintiffs would have to show a threat of imminent injury. And if the new policy was in effect, which was faith neutral, rather than the old policy, there's a substantial question whether or not the allegations, even on their face, are sufficient to show imminent injury.
I just don't, I don't see in this complaint, I've said this to plaintiff's counsel, I'll say it to you, but I just don't see that they're challenging this new policy in this complaint. I mean, I just opened it up to count three. That count three is the Navy has established and maintained an unconstitutional religious quota system. It goes on and on and on. And then the counts one and two are all about the thirds policy. And count four is more of the same.
I agree, Your Honor. I think that's an absolutely fair characterization of the complaint. As I understand counsel's theory, it's because the old policy and the new policy both employ what's called a care board, which is an advisory board that makes recommendations for accession to chain of command. And it's that, as I understand counsel's argument, it's that common thread that brings his complaint.
Does the complaint anywhere allege that the use of a care board which is staffed with people belonging to denominations is itself unconstitutional?
I don't remember such a claim, Your Honor. Obviously, counsel for the plaintiffs would be a better person to indicate if I'm mistaken, but I don't remember any such complaint. And there is one thing I want to very clearly mention. Even if it would be appropriate for counsel to rely on the commonality of the care board between the two policies, the plaintiff's own expert, analyzing their own data, agree that from 2000 on, the accession rates have converged for the different faith groups. So there is not a statistically significant difference.
There's at least confusion there, at least in my mind, about whether we're talking about convergence as to faith group clusters or faith groups. And can you point me to something in the record that shows convergence with respect to faith groups as opposed to faith group clusters?
No, Your Honor. I think it is more appropriately stated, and perhaps I was too quick to say that. I think it is faith group clusters, the four different categories.
So to the extent that there is some sort of an as-applied claim with respect to faith groups, we don't have grounds for affirming such summary judgment against that. That'd be correct.
I don't think that has been raised, at least as far as I can tell, by the plaintiffs at this stage in the litigation. Perhaps I've missed something, Your Honor, and of course I'd be happy to be corrected. In any event, as I point out, the commonality of the care boards in both of the two policies is not sufficient if there is not evidence of discrimination under the current policy, and if that current policy is, as appears to be conceded, completely neutral with regard to faith of the applicant. I'm happy to answer any additional questions the court has, but Judge Williams, were you?
Well, I thought I had my finger on it, but I don't seem to.
So it's your theory. Theory then that there's, for whatever reason, there's no jurisdiction here.
Because yes, Your Honor. Whether you'd like to call it standing or whether it's more appropriately thought of as mootness, mm-hmm. there is no jurisdiction. I will say, with regard to the mootness and with regard to the claim that the Navy at any time could reinstitute the policy. This case is, I believe, on all fours with Your Honor's opinion for the court in Worth. There was a challenge to a HUD affirmative action policy. At the time of the suit, there was a HUD official who filed an affidavit stating, quote, "We will not renew," end quote, the policy that was in effect at the time the agency acted. And this court said as to that, that ends the matter.
Yeah, but you haven't said that, have you?
Yes, Your Honor, we have.
You have an affidavit that says that? Or
the Black Declaration, Joint Appendix 998, uh-huh. The Chaplain Corps no longer establishes recruiting goals by faith group clusters.
Yeah, but that's not the same as saying you'll never do it again.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, the HUD official did not say we will never do it again. He said we will not renew the policy. That didn't say for all time.
That's a good point.
And in especially in light of that declaration and the absence of any allegation in the complaint or otherwise that the Navy is going to reinstitute the old policy, there's just simply no basis for suggesting that it will come forward. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'd like to make one very last point before I sit down. Your Honor, Judge Tatel mentioned that Goldman was appropriate in a free exercise case. It is absolutely our position that Goldman is applicable outside of the free exercise context as well. Just the one point I'd like to make about that is Goldman itself relied on other cases giving deference and recognizing that a different metric is used when analyzing constitutional challenges in the military context. Goldman relies on Chappelle, which was an equal protection Bivens case, and Orloff, which was a habeas case. And I could also cite as an example the Gilligan case, which was a free speech and assembly case.
It wasn't an Establishment Clause case.
No, Your Honor, but the point is the reason why courts give deference a different and use a different type of metric in constitutional challenges to military actions is because of the separation of powers, because of
well,
the recognized...
You could articulate, I think, a very good reason for having a different standard for an Establishment Clause claim as opposed to a free exercise claim. But you would give a lot less deference. I mean, suppose the military established a military religion.
Well, Your Honor, I think that would be
would
because...
Would you give deference to that?
No, Your Honor. There are clearly boundaries to the limits of the doctrine, but I don't think that that's an exception to the doctrine. I just think that shows the boundaries. After all, if the military deference weren't appropriate at all, then it would be significantly more questionable whether or not the maintenance of a chaplain corps in the first place...
I would have thought your better argument would be that actually they have brought a free exercise claim.
Well,
that's what they're really complaining
about. To be quite
about,
honest,
right?
Your Honor, they seem to have intermingled the claims. They
well,
do
no,
seem
but don't you think, what do you think about that? I mean, don't you think their, I mean, their argument really does sound like a free exercise claim that the way the military is now running the chaplain program, it isn't adequately responding to the religious needs of service members.
Yes, Your Honor, that
doesn't
aspect
that
of the
like
claim,
a free exercise claim?
That aspect of the claim absolutely does sound like a free exercise claim. The part that sounds more establishment related is the use of chaplains on the care boards, for example. They claim that it seems to be an establishment of religion, despite the fact that the chaplains are themselves commissioned officers of the United States Navy. But I absolutely agree with Your Honor's characterization of their claim.
Before you sit down,
yes, Your Honor.
As far as the mootness argument regarding the thirds policy is concerned, what's your answer to the claim that they're seeking constructive credit, and that's not that saves it from mootness?
To the extent that there were available damages, I agree that if there were legally available damages, that would not moot out a challenge to a policy that has no longer been in place. However, Your Honor, under this court's decision in Kidwell, the relevant question is to ask is whether or not the relief the plaintiff is seeking would require that monetary benefits flow directly from a district court's exercise of judgment or would just be a result of the structure of regulations and statutes. The former is prohibited. It's barred
well,
by the Tucker.
What they're asking for is sort of they'd get their seniority. In other words, they wouldn't get back pay, but they get their new jobs.
That probably would not be barred, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, I think...
Well, that's what they're asking for, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, the complaint on its face uses a couple of different claims concerning this. First of all, there's an explicit request for retirement pay. That's a Joint Appendix 33. Mm-hmm. That's an unambiguous request for money. The more ambiguous term is constructive credit.
Right.
And I think the nature of that claim was made readily apparent by the plaintiff's opening brief, where they ask for a Bivens-type remedy, restitution. It's very clear that what they are talking about is money.
Has the Navy explained why it adopted the new non-denominational system as opposed to going back to the pre-1987 system?
Frankly, Your Honor, I'm not sure if it's in the record. I could tell Your Honor that it is, although we think both of the systems, both of the policies are readily defensible on the merits, it's absolutely clear that a religiously neutral policy raises fewer constitutional questions. The older policy was not, as a practical matter, was not particularly effective. There were problems with meeting the needs of the Navy.
And those problems arose from what?
I think just staffing. They were not able to get adequate staffing.
You're basically saying that the only way, or at least that it seemed in the Navy, that it sort of it maximized its ability to satisfy free exercise demands.
Yes, Your Honor.
The denomination neutral system.
Yes, Your Honor. And for the last 8 years, that's the policy the Navy's been acting under. And it's not perfect. There are still some shortfalls and still some imperfections in the system. But it has, for the most part, worked for the Navy. And this is the policy that the Navy's been sticking with.
How are the members of the CARE Board chosen?
Is
there anything in the record?
There is something in the record, Your Honor. I'm sorry I don't have a reference right off the top of my head. I'm very happy to submit a very short.
Just tell me.
I know that there are by, I believe, Secretary of the Navy orders or instructions, categories of individuals to be selected. As to who does the selecting and whether there's a rotation, I don't know that mechanism off the top of my head.
Is there
but
any indication that there's a quota system in selecting the members of the CARE Board?
That I can categorically say absolutely not.
I'm just looking at paragraph 30 of the complaint, which talks about the delegation of authority to the Chaplain Corps and says that the delegation, violates the First Amendment because the Navy's delegation has been and remains without guarantees to assure that it's used for secular, neutral, and non-ideological purposes. I guess the plaintiffs rely on that for their notion that the original claim against the old policy applies with equal, at least so far as this is part of the claim, with equal force to the new policy.
I think with regard to that, two things, Your Honor. First, as I mentioned before, to the extent that there's no dispute that the accession rates are not, that there is not a statistically significant difference among faith groups, I think that eliminates that claim on the merits. But in any event, I guess what I would want to point out is two things. This is the plaintiff's Grummet or Larkin type argument. This was referred to but not argued in the opening brief, and so we think it's mm-hmm. waived. It was extensively discussed in the reply brief, but that's obviously mm-hmm. too late. In any event, on the merits, Larkin and Grummet are very different cases than this one. In both of those cases, there was delegation to absolutely non-governmental entities. Here, we're talking about officers of the United States Navy who have sworn to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States and are subject to the chain of command of the Navy. They are unambiguously governmental officials, military officials, and so it's just apples and oranges, and Grummet and Larkin are simply in opposite. In any event, it's also not true that there is no guiding principle for the CARE Boards. They're given criteria that they can use. They're not what the plaintiffs would call objective criteria, but Joint Appendix 1196 and the Gwantley Declaration cites some of the criteria that are considered, including existence of ecclesiastical endorsement, academic performance, graduate theological education, professional ministry experience, professional reputation, letters of recommendation, and results from interviews. All of these things are
allegation that Judge Williams referred to is an allegation that the delegation's invalid because the Chaplain Corps is establishing goals, policies, and programs. That's about the third's policy. It's not about the
That's government. Absolutely right, too, Your Honor.
Right.
The Court has no further questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Schultz, you're way out of time, but we'll give you a minute.
I thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, let me address the issue about the complaint. Paragraphs 32 and 35 specifically talk about procedures and policies. Paragraph 32 of the complaint, it's on page 27 of the Joint Appendix. The Navy's current failure to develop and maintain recruiting goals that are closely related to meeting the DON's free exercise needs also fails strict scrutiny and violates the First Amendment. Judge Williams, I believe, mentioned paragraphs 30. And under paragraph 35, the Navy's chaplain accession policies and practices, which clearly indicates the current as well as the former system, intentionally discriminate against plaintiffs without
past tense there, interestingly enough.
Discriminated, yes, Your Honor. Well, when they applied, they were discriminated against. When Lindsay applied, they were discriminated against. These policies and practices were not then and are not now narrowly tailored or closely fitted to accomplish any legitimate government purpose. If the purpose of the Chaplain Corps is to meet free exercise needs and alleviate the burden, then it has to be related to that process. This circuit's precedent for establishment clauses to the establishment clause challenges to the military is Anderson v. Laird, and there was no deference granted to the Army as it challenged the mandatory chapel practices of the service academies. It rejected the Army's allegations that this was necessary for their training.
Counsel for the government said that there's no burden here because your client testified that he could function as a liturgical minister. Is that true?
Your Honor, he's talking about endorsement.
Uh-huh. He's talking about
and the burden.
Let's talk about what
they
might have said.
Your Honor, Lindsay said he could perhaps get an endorsement from another. He could find a liturgical endorser. The question had to do with endorsement.
Well, why would he want that unless he was prepared to work as a liturgical minister?
Well, he was perhaps willing to do that.
Well, but then doesn't that greatly diminish any argument that there's any burden on him here if he's prepared to function in the other category? That's the government's argument.
Your Honor, the question is what he was able to do. Apparently, he wasn't capable of doing that. He was denied because of his non-liturgical endorsement. And the issue, Your Honor, asked the question about what the standards are. They're completely subjective standards. In fact, I asked specifically the person who was on Lindsay's board, I said, what standards did you use? He could not identify any. He couldn't tell why Lindsay was rejected. There is, contrary to counsel's statement,
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I apologize, Your Honor. Thank you.